Mini episode 466 of the FDH Lounge is brought to you by Sportsology, delivering unconventional columns and webcasts about sports, TV, music, movies, and more. Follow them on the web at sportsology.info.
The FDH Lounge. You want to schedule your life around it.
A long time ago, on a gloomy, wet Cleveland spring night, two men stand alone amidst the late night drizzle. Their voices echo across the vacant station parking lot as they debate the merits of the great American radio show that have been missing for far too long. On that night, an idea was born. That idea became the FDH Lounge. Welcome to the FDH Lounge.
Welcome, everyone, to FDH Lounge, mini episode number 466. This is FDH Managing Partner Rick Morris. And we are very pleased to welcome back to the show a gentleman who was our first musical guest, actually, in the relatively early days of the show, our second year on the air. We've since had about two dozen figures from all different parts of the music world on the show. But on June 20th, 2008, he was our first musical guest. And I believe this also makes the longest period of time in the history of the show between first and second appearances. This is definitely a gentleman who is worth the wait as far as getting him back on the program. He currently he heads up the jazz band Vital Information. He's doing a little bit more work these days in the field of jazz as opposed to rock, but has a tremendous background in rock as well. All I really need to say about that is Journey During the Peak Years. That's all I need to say on that subject. He was voted by Modern Drummer one of the top 25 of all time. He is also a member of their Hall of Fame. And when you're talking drumming, two of the sacred names out there are Neil Peart and Buddy Rich. He was invited by Neil Peart to participate on a Buddy Rich tribute album back in the 90s. That subsequently led to an association with the Buddy's Buddies group, which is now Steve Smith's Jazz Legacy. And again, he is the editor and one of the contributors to The Roots of Rock Drumming, Interviews with the Drummers Who Shaped Rock and Roll Music, this outstanding book and DVD project. We're going to be talking about that. And again, I want to thank him and his people for getting this book out there to us. And it's a really, really outstanding piece of work. Steve was the first member of Journey to be on the program with us. As I said, he was our first musical guest overall. We've actually had four of them now. It's nice to be able to bring him back on. The others who have been on since, of course, Greg Raleigh, Steve Perry, and Ross Valerie. But the man who got it started, who was our first musical conversation in the history of the show, coming back on with us today, the legendary drummer Steve Smith. Steve, welcome back to the FDH Lounge, sir. Pleasure to have you on today. How are you?
I'm good, Rick. I had no idea I was the first guest. If I did, I had completely forgotten at this point. So the first musical guest, that's pretty great.
It covers a lot of ground. Yeah, I was and I was just remarking on it, and it's kind of a sad thing. I caught up with three of the members of Survivor last month when they were backstage in Cleveland. Yes, including Jimmy Jameson, and I said, hey, this now makes four members of Survivor that we've had on, tying Journey for the most members of a group that we've had on. But I should ask probably at the outset on that subject there. I know a lot of members of the melodic rock community. There's a lot of cross currents. And everything. Did you ever have the opportunity to cross paths much with the great Jimmy Jameson?
No, I didn't know him. No, so I don't think I ever did meet him.
Okay. He's a guy we were fortunate to have on three different times through the course of the show, and we recorded a tribute with him with his good friend Bobby Kimball, and it was a pleasure to get to flush out his life and times. But speaking of which, with your career, this is just really, it's an amazing piece of work that you were able to draw upon with everything you've done, putting into this book. And the fact that the book, I'm fascinated by the subject of it starting, I guess, more as a video project in the early 2000s, getting shelved for the better part of a decade due to various obstacles and coming back. Tell us the story, please, of what went into
Sure.
this project, some of the obstacles involved, and how it came to be.
Well, to go back to the roots of how this book came to be, it really started when I was doing preparation to get back together with Journey in 1996, when we got back together after an 11-year hiatus to do the album called Trial by Fire. And I grew up more or less a jazz drummer. In my early years, growing up in Boston, I was a big band fan, and then I went into loving all the fusion groups that were developing in the early 70s when I graduated from high school in 72. Went to Berklee and Berklee College of Music in Boston, and by the time I started touring professionally with Jean-Luc Ponty, that was the beginning of me playing in a bit more of a rock style. It was jazz fusion, and eventually the guys in Journey heard me and had me play in the band. When I played in Journey in those early years, my concept of rock drumming was very much just, I would call, like an organic approach based on years of listening to Cream and Jimi Hendrix and Led Zeppelin. But unlike jazz, I had never really studied rock drumming and studied where it came from. When I play jazz and study jazz, I study the whole history of jazz drumming, which is an important part of learning how to play jazz. But I realized right before we did that get-together, Trial by Fire, that I wanted to do a serious study of the roots of rock drumming myself. So it was my own personal project that I just read lots of books, Sounds of the City, for instance, you know, like a book on the history of rock. I read dozens of books and then bought probably hundreds of CDs so I could really be more of a, let's say, an educated expert on rock drumming walking into that Journey reunion. And it was a lot of fun, and it was helpful to do that. And, I really studied the singing and the, you know, the music of Sam Cooke, because that's Steve Perry's number one influence, and Jackie Wilson probably his number two influence, and then all the great blues guitarists that Neil grew up listening to. And, you know, I had a lot to go on as far as who I knew their influences were. And then I just kept going with that. And I find it fascinating what I started to learn. And basically, at the end of the day, what I found out is most of the early so-called rock drummers, like DJ Fontana, who played with Elvis, or Earl Palmer, who played with Little Richard, they were all a lot like me. They just grew up playing jazz, but they were offered studio work because they were the most professional drummers in town. And they played on many of these groundbreaking early rock records from the early 50s, the mid 50s, and the late 50s, and then into the early 60s. So that went, you know, so I did the reunion with Journey. We had a great time. I was able to contribute some parts to the music that made even more sense than what I played before, because I had such a better command over the roots of rock drumming myself. And then in 2002, I was doing an educational video for Hudson Music, largely based on what I learned. I called that video The History of the U.S. Beat, where I really trace the whole history of drumming and where it came from, jazz, and then how it evolved into rock and then jazz rock fusion. And so I presented the people from Hudson Music the idea of, why don't we go around the country and even to England and interview these drummers, because many of them are quite old and, you know, and not going to be around forever, and hear their story, you know, hear how, what it was like for them to record with Little Richard or Elvis or Buddy Holly. And the focus isn't the whole history of rock drumming. It's really the early years, like we call it, the roots of rock drumming, basically starting in the late 40s, early 50s, and taking us up to about 1965 when the Beatles and the Stones came on, because most people really know a lot about rock drumming after that. But it's before that's mysterious, because there really weren't many credits on the records. A lot of people didn't realize who these session musicians were that played on the Chuck Berry records and all these kind of early blues records and early rockabilly albums. So I traced out a lot of these guys. We went with a camera crew and filmed quite a few interviews. So it was a great project and great to meet all these drummers. And I did interview quite a few of them. And then the other guys got involved and started doing their interviews. And basically, like you mentioned, it did sit on the shelf for about 10 years after like 2002, 2003, because we wanted to make it into a movie, but the licensing fees involved to license songs and videos of Elvis and Buddy Holly and Little Richard, et cetera, people like that, was just astronomical, and we couldn't afford it. So it wasn't until we came up with the idea to have the interviews transcribed, but then we needed a good editor. I didn't have time to edit the whole thing, but we met Daniel Glass, who is a very good drummer himself. He's in the Royal Crown Review. He was playing with Brian Setzer, and really an expert on this kind of early history. He's written a number of books himself. So he very ably did the lion's share of the editing, and then I would edit his editing, and, you know, we would do fact-checking, and so that's really the evolution of how the whole thing came to be. And it really wasn't until we met Daniel Glass that we could come up with the completed project. He had the time and the energy and the expertise to really bring these transcribed interviews to a readable place.
Well, it's a very, very interesting project, and I'm sure that nobody who heard your explanation just now will be surprised in terms of, again, you're a very inquisitive man about this kind of thing and conducting the clinics as you have over the years. You're a very big theoretician as far as the practice of drumming in addition to being a performer. So that really kind of shone through in this book, no question about it. I'm curious because, again, and I'm going to preface this by saying that this and any other technical questions that I ask are all going to be really from a layman's standpoint, but that's fine because probably most of the audience is in the same place too, so it'll help to kind of have it broken down that way. My sense is, for somebody like you with your versatility, with, as you said, first starting out with the jazz drumming, then getting into rock drumming when the opportunity arose with Journey and with going back and forth between the two over the years, my sense is that it's almost like two separate skill sets to do that. Is it really that big of a difference going back and forth? And did the perception change from doing this book? Was there anything in the course of doing the book that changed your perspective on similarities or differences between rock and jazz drumming?
Well, in the early years, and when I say that, let's just say the 50s, there was not a wide gap between jazz drumming and rock drumming, because in those early years, the jazz feel is based on a swing beat, you know, that kind of beat. And then the early rock beat is basically that same beat, but with an accented 2 and 4, an so basically it's like the same beat, but the drummer plays an accented 2 and 4 all the way through the tune. That was one of the ways we identified, well, what exactly is rock drumming in those early years? Well, the difference is you're not just playing the beat on the cymbal, as in jazz, but you're playing the beat on the cymbal and then adding that backbeat 2 and 4 on the snare drum. And that's really the innovation of those early rock and roll records, is they had that backbeat all the way through the song. In the big band days, they used to do that, but it would only be on what they call the out chorus. It would be like the final 30 seconds of the tune, like a big ending, and a drummer would play that 2 and 4. And so then, as things evolved in rock, the influence of Boogie Woogie came in, and then that swing beat started to go from what we call the straight eighth feel. So it doesn't have so much of that swing, but it's a more even eighth. So that's when it got to be a little bit different feel between jazz and rock. Though, interestingly, jazz then adopted that feel into a lot of jazz, which is then you could say the beginning of jazz rock, you know, so one then influenced the other. And so as it gets further into the present, there's more of a difference between jazz drumming and rock drumming, and so much of it really has to do with intensity and volume. As far as this keeping time and making time feel good to the other musicians and to the audience, there's a lot of similarity that a drummer has to have a nice feel to their playing, has to have a very good steady beat. That's ubiquitous in either, you know, that's just going to be the same in either jazz or rock. But there's then separate, somewhat separate vocabulary that you're going to have to play that's going to sound right if I'm doing a rock track with Neil Sean on like his solo record. Like, for instance, I've been playing on his last couple of solo records. That's going to take a bit of a different approach than if I'm on tour with Mike Stern, also another great guitarist, but a jazz fusion guitarist. It's going to be closer to those jazz roots. Still going to be playing a bit of a rock feel, because some of the modern jazz has incorporated a lot of the rock and funk feel. But still, there's an element of looseness and swing. And, of course, the major difference between the two is with rock, I play more compositionally, meaning I play drum parts. For instance, you know, like if you know the song Don't Stop Believin', it's got a very composed drum part. Or if mm-hmm. I play Separate Ways, those are composed drum parts. I don't play them differently every night. You know, when I played on tour with Journey, I pretty much played the same drum part every night. And versus jazz music, if I did that, it wouldn't be jazz. You know, there's right. a demand to not play it the same. You have to be creative and be innovative in the moment and really come up with new ideas. Even though it's the same song and the same structure, the playing and the communication between the musician demands that there be freedom and improvisation. So, you know, and it's based on particular kind of vocabulary that had its start in the roots of jazz. So there's similarities, there's differences, but having the, you know, experience of both, I'm able to make those transitions from one to the other.
That's a great point, because I can tell you that from being at rock concerts and at jazz concerts, I've had the sense sometimes at rock concerts of, hey, man, just play it like the album. And, you know, and I don't ever had that sense at jazz concerts as much. There seems to be more freedom accorded. You know, you're probably right about that.
Yeah, I'm definitely right about that. Yeah, because if somebody, in that way, rock music is closer to classical music, in that mm-hmm. there's a composition, and then in classical music, you know, it's written on the page, and the orchestra plays it, the notes are going to be the same. The difference is going to be in the interpretation, who's the conductor, who's playing. You know, and with a rock song, of course, there's going to be slight variations from night to night. But essentially, once the composition is established, it is played very close to the original. And of course, then there's all those variations of, okay, well, is it a band like the Allman Brothers that stretches out versus is it a band like Rush that plays at the same time every single night, you know, and then variations in between. So
that's a great point, yeah. Because I don't ever remember being cheesed off at Maynard Ferguson or Chuck Mangione for doing it a little bit different in concert there. You kind of expected that, but yeah, that's a great point.
Yeah.
You really don't expect that in the rock world as much. I want to ask you about technique on something that's a little bit closer to something that I can understand directly and have had experience with, and that being the process of conducting the interview/conversations for this book. I was really taken by the fact that the book basically more or less flows, I'd say, in a similar manner to something like this program, where it's more like a conversation between us rather than a question and answer. So my sense on that is, you know, you must be somebody who had some kind of training somewhere along the way, or is this a completely autodidactic thing? What was basically your process for getting ready to do a book like this, because I thought that the conversations that you did flowed excellently?
Well, I've done enough interviews myself that I had a good idea of how to conduct an interview, and over mm-hmm. the years I've met enough drummers and just in conversation just talk to them in some ways like I was interviewing them, in the way that I wanted to learn about who they were and what they did. But before I interviewed each drummer, I first of all had a template of questions that I wanted to ask each drummer, and I wanted to ask many of the drummers the same exact questions, because I had the idea, like, let's say a more like a Ken Burns documentary, I'd put out an idea and then I'd hear five different answers, or five or six, et cetera, you know, different people answering the same question, so we could see where there's similarities and where there's differences. So I started with a template. I did a lot of research on each drummer. Even though I knew about many of them, I really wanted to make sure I was familiar with their body of work. So I bought the albums and listened to the tunes and came up with questions based on specific tunes and parts. And I also made it clear to all these drummers, especially people like DJ Fontana, who is Elvis's drummer, or Jerry Allison, who is Buddy Holly's drummer. This isn't going to be an interview about what was Elvis really like or what was Buddy Holly really like. This is going to be an interview about them and about their experience in playing the music in the studio and then playing it live, and what's their life like, and what it's really all about, the drumming and about them. And a few of them were a little hesitant at first, but once we got into it, they had a ball with it, because for once in a row, we were talking about them, and it wasn't all about the superstars that they had played with. So they really were able to tell their story in a very unprecedented way. Plus, I'm a drummer, so there was no language barrier. Whatever I asked them drum-wise, they could answer me. And even though many people that read this book are not drummers, they can still follow the thread enough. And even though we do get into some detail about technique and music concepts, there's still enough of a thread that the non-musician can really follow the story and appreciate what the contribution of these drummers were to the creation, what we now know as rock music, whereas... here, another interesting story that came out, because when I said originally, when I interviewed many of these drummers, I asked them the same question, and one of the questions was, how do you see yourself as a drummer? And Earl Palmer, who was the drummer on many of the Little Richard records, said, I'm a bebop drummer. And then I asked DJ, who's Elvis's drummer, how do you see yourself as a drummer? Oh, I'm a swing drummer, and I wanted to play like Gene Krupa in big bands. And the first drummer that answered me that he wanted to be a rock drummer was Jerry Allison, and he was the drummer with the Crickets, Buddy Holly, and the Crickets. And they were a band. It wasn't like Buddy Holly and some sidemen. They were like the Beatles, really. They were a four-piece, one of the very first rock band, an equal-member band. And he said, I wanted to be a rock drummer. But he didn't know to call it that, because in those days they hadn't invented the word rock and roll yet. But he knew that he didn't want to play jazz, and he wanted to play rhythm and blues, which is what they called it then. So in other words, that was, to me, a way of saying, well, maybe he's one of the very first, if not the first, rock drummers, because that was his intention. Even though DJ Fontana recorded Jailhouse Rock before Buddy Holly recorded That'll Be the Day, but DJ didn't consider himself a rock drummer. He was just a jazz musician with a great rock gig. But Jerry wanted to be a rock drummer. And then J.M. Van Eaton, who was the house drummer at Sun Records, he also wanted to be a rock drummer. Interestingly, they were the youngest people, when they were both 17 years old when they were making these records. So that made sense. They were young. They had grown up listening to Little Richard and Elvis, and they wanted to do that. But drummers before that had never grown up listening to rock, because it didn't exist. They grew up listening to Gene Krupa and Louis Armstrong and jazz music. That's what they wanted to play, but that's not what their professional, even though they did play some jazz, but that's not really where their professional life led them. So it's interesting to follow those threads and hear those musicians tell those stories.
It is fascinating because, they were sort of collectively inventing the art form as they went along, because, as you said, they were essentially the first generation of it. And everything that you said about not needing to know much about drumming to take even some entertainment from the stories on technique, that's the figurative drum that I've been beating about this book, is that I felt that it was very interesting just to see the X's and O's sort of getting drawn on the chalkboard there, so to speak. And along those lines, you anticipated perfectly. I was going to ask you about your conversation with J.M. Van Eaton, where you guys were talking about how he was popularizing the method of the shuffle. So here's where I sort of revert back to layman's questions here, and as far as how that goes. Were you influenced at all by what he had done with that, or any of the other folks that you had talked to? Were there specific things along the way that you had incorporated as you were learning about drumming from these guys where you got a chance to ask them about that?
Well, I was influenced by all of these guys, and sometimes directly by listening to some of these albums when I was younger, and then all indirectly by their influence on the next generation and the next couple of generations, because it's very easy to trace the influences of these drummers to then, of course, Ringo and Charlie Watts and Mitch Mitchell and John Bonham, you know, and more of the guys that I grew up listening to. So I would say, but later I became more influenced by these early drummers because I spent so much time doing that research and really discovering the beauty of their playing and hearing rock drumming in its earlier form before it was, you know, before it had started to change more and more. There's always something valuable going back to the well and hearing the original before you start hearing the influences and how things develop later on. So, yeah, I would say I was definitely influenced by these drummers, but it was more in the early 90s when I was doing my research and really listening closely to these records. And that's what I would suggest, is that people read the book, and as they're mentioning, oh, yeah, like, you know, that when I played on, you know, Hal Blaine played on this Jan and Dean or Beach Boys record, listen to the music and listen to what he says, what they're playing, or Sam Lay playing on a, you know, on a Bob Dylan track or a Paul Butterfield Blues Band track. Listen to the track and hear it, and you can hear the influence that they had on the music, because this music was, for the most part, sometimes can sound like it's being credited to one guy, like, you know, just to pick an Elvis or Jerry Lee Lewis. But and the reality is they would bring a germ of an idea into the studio, and then it was the collective participation of all the musicians involved that really developed the music that you hear in its final form. And it wasn't like people going in with here's the demo of the tune and it's all done, now learn your parts. No way. It was just they had these ideas, germs of an idea, and then these musicians brought it to life. And these drummers played a key role in that.
And the conversations with them, again, just illuminated all of this. And, again, it was just very interesting because, you know, the tapestry of your career, everyone that you've interacted with as far as performance, now for you to be taking that to the realm of interviewing them, drawing out their stories. You've had such a fascinating interaction in all different kind of spheres with so many great musical talents. And you mentioned one of them previously, one of the ones who definitely ranks as one of the bigger household names that you've been associated with, that, of course, being Steve Perry. You noted previously about his love of Sam Cooke, and actually in the course of our conversation with him, that was sort of somewhat of a bonding moment between us, because it turns out that both of our mothers were Sam Cooke enthusiasts, and that was something we got from them. And he sang a couple notes of Cupid there, which I would later joke was the first time he'd recorded anything in 13 years. But it was, you know, so it was, what a thrill it was as he busted into the acapella. And nobody was more surprised at that moment than I was. And, it was a big thrill. But, I have to say, he's been dipping his toe out there again recently somewhat, I guess, with public performing. Is that anything that you've heard about from him as far as what direction that might go?
I haven't heard from him, no. So I've heard that he's been doing some sitting in, and that's great, but I haven't personally heard from him for quite a while.
Okay. Yeah, just was curious about that. Yeah, it's going to be a notable thing when and if there is a greater presence out there, no question about it. But, again, as we indicated, even before this book came out, The Roots of Rock Drumming, interviews with the drummers who shaped rock and roll music, and the accompanying DVD, of course, that is an excellent, I guess, cherry on top of the sundae of what's been your career with performance and all the different genres that you have participated in over the course of the years. I know you've still got everything going on with your jazz band, Vital Information. Anything else the people should know about as far as what's presently going on with you?
Well, I've been touring a lot with Mike Stern, great jazz guitarist, and I'll be touring with him next year. I finished touring with him this year. I'm also touring with an amazing Japanese jazz piano player named Hiromi. And I've been working with her over the last 3 years. And we're going to be touring the USA and Europe in October and November. And I don't have all the dates up because they're not all finalized, but you can go to my website, which is vitalinformation.com, and the tour dates will be posted there, and I'll continue to update those. And I've been touring with a great Indian tabla player named Zakir Hussain, amazing musician, really the premier musician from India. We just did a tour of the USA, playing symphony halls around the country and a little bit in Canada as well. And that's where I play in more of an Indian style on the U.S. drum set. But, you know, but I've been studying Indian music for the last 12 years as well. So, and I'm touring India with him. The group is called Zakir Hussain and the Masters of Percussion. And there's five percussionists, a sitar player and a sarangi player. So it's a very Indian oriented, and the music is percussion based. So that we did a U.S. tour, so for the U.S. listeners, they won't get to see this group again this year. But we're going to, in December, we're touring all over India. So that's a big thrill for me to be embraced by the Indian community. I was actually the first non-Indian musician to ever tour with the group, and really the first drum set player to tour with the group as well. So that's an ongoing passion of mine. And my Vital Information group, I have an album coming out next March, and then I'm working on the next one after that, and where I'm going to incorporate even more of this Indian influence into our music. So, you know, I'm constantly doing something. So it's, you know, I don't get a chance to rest too much, but it's interesting to be doing all the, you know, all this great playing and involved in studying and different music and just continuing to progress as a musician.
Wow. Yeah. I mean, you mentioned first the Japanese element and now the Indian. I mean, again, there are very, very few musicians, I would say, at your level of accomplishment who are continuing to be as adventurous and kind of expanding your horizons the way that you are. It's truly unbelievable. I'd say, you know, for all the great guests we've had on the show, I think you're probably showing a greater diversity than just about any of them I can think of off the top of my head. So it's very unbelievable, everything that you're continuing to do there. People should continue to check everything out. Vitalinformation.com, as you said, a good place where people can learn about that. And, of course, this book, The Roots of Rock Drumming, Interviews with the Drummers Who Shaped Rock and Roll Music. And, again, a book/DVD project that was just a wonderful accomplishment by you guys. I want to thank you so much for having sent out a copy of it and for having been here today for another conversation. I truly hope that we get another one in before 6 years go by this time. But a true pleasure to have you on, Steve. God bless, and good luck with all the projects you have going presently.
Sure. Well, thank you, Rick. And just to mention where folks can get the book, probably the most direct route would be Amazon. It's, as you said, the Roots of Rock Drumming, and it's Hudson Music is the name of the company that put it out, distributed by Hal Leonard. It's also at Barnes & Noble and at many drum shops, if you happen to go by a drum shop or a music store, it may be in there as well. And, we had an awesome time making the book. And when you mentioned there is a DVD, and what that DVD has on it is some of the interview footage with these drummers, just, you know, 8-9 minute clips of each guy. The DVD is about 2 hours and 45 minutes long, but it just has about 8 to 10 minutes of most all of the drummers that are interviewed in the book. So that makes some pretty interesting viewing. And you know, we mentioned a lot of the U.S. drummers, but I also went to London and interviewed many of the drummers from London who played with Petula Clark and Tom Jones and the Kinks and the Shadows and a lot of those early groups and that were making hits in the late 50s and the early 60s. And they have a very interesting story to tell as well. So it really covers a lot of ground. And so I want to thank you a lot for having me on and bring some attention to this book and to these great musicians that really shaped the early years of rock and roll drumming.
Well, it's my pleasure, Steve. It is a wonderful piece of work, and I can tell you again, I mean, as far as a personal endorsement goes, my little nephew, I'm not sure if he's going to stick with drums or if he's going to go with another musical instrument. I hear varying things on that. I want to make sure if he sticks with the drums that he reads this book cover to cover, because, again, there's great stories in it, but there's much to be learned in terms of technique and how to get better, and it really serves both purposes so well. Thank you so much for your time, Steve. Look forward to having you back on the program, and, again, best of luck with all your travels.
Great. Thanks so much. Bye-bye.
Thank you, Steve, and thank you all, everybody, for tuning in today to mini episode number 466 of the FDH Lounge.
As we bring the show to a close, we would like to extend our deepest gratitude to NBC, CBS, ABC, Fox, all Clear Channel affiliates, TNT, TBS, USA, UPN, Deadspin.com, YouTube.com, YTMND.com, MySpace.com, various blogs, Fox News, CNN, CNBC, MSNBC, IamBored.com, Billboard.com, Google.com, ESPN, ESPN2, ESPN News, ESPN Classic, NBA TV, NFL Network, Sports Time Ohio, Athlon Magazine, Comedy Central, Cartoon Network, The Boomerang Channel, QVC, BET, The Spice Channel, Steno Notebooks, Manwich, Papermate Office Supplies, Waitresses, Strippers, Bartenders, Garbage Men, Janitors, Microwave Popcorn, The Writers of The Office, Scrubs, Entourage, My Name is Earl, Oz, Metalocalypse and the Boondocks, Awkwafina, and The Periodic Table of Elements.